This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. Day in and day out all around the world, highly trained epidemiologists are constantly on watch for the next bug that might result in widespread mortality. In Jefferson County, that guardian is Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke. This week on the Compass, we talk with Dr. Locke about the threat posed by the new coronavirus that's been dubbed COVID-19 and the plans that are being laid to deal with what he believes is the inevitable local spread of the potentially lethal virus. So now, let's go inside the Compass. Last week, Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke was a hard man to get to see. Multiple calls and emails went unanswered before an apologetic return call led to an appointment for an interview, which was then twice postponed as emergency meetings to plan for what is expected to be perhaps the biggest public health event of his career, the imminent arrival of the COVID-19 virus on the Olympic Peninsula. But finally, in the late afternoon of Thursday, March 5th, I was able to sit down and talk with him in the quiet confines of what is known as the lactation room at the public health offices on Sheridan Street. I guess you've been pretty busy over the last several weeks.
Yes, indeed. We've been monitoring this since December, and it's really kicked into high gear when Washington identified the first case of COVID-19 in the United States. And that now seems like a long time ago, but it was.
When was that?
That was Martin Luther King weekend in January, so the third week in January.
When did it first hit your radar, though? I mean, it must have been something that public health officials in the United States were looking at well prior to its arriving here.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, we monitor these what are called novel infections all the time. There's actually several candidates in the world now, different types of avian influenza and what we call emerging infections that have the potential for broad spread. And there's a system for monitoring them. Unfortunately, the current administration disabled or dismantled part of that system that monitors for outbreaks in other countries. There was a time we actually had public health workers stationed in other countries ready to evaluate these just as it started up. We did not have that in place for this outbreak, but we're monitoring it nonetheless because it seemed to be spreading very rapidly in China. And what we look for is things that are highly contagious and ones where the people don't get so sick that they're incapacitated and they can't move around, because that's not good for a virus's survival. If a virus kills all of its hosts, it actually does not spread worldwide. But a virus that can make people sick, but not so sick that they can't still move around, that has the potential to go pandemic. And that's what's happening in this case. This is a virus that's highly contagious, and 80% of people who get it have very mild illness or sometimes no symptoms at all. So it's the 20% that get really sick from it, and some get very so sick they need to be hospitalized, and if they have chronic medical conditions or if they're elderly, they're at risk of dying of it.
I know that one of the real questions has been how soon after exposure one can become communicable themselves.
We're learning more and more each day, and what we know at this point, what we call the median incubation time. So what the majority of people who get exposed and then get sick, it's in the 5 to 8 day range. And so what we're using as our operational quarantine period is we're using 14 days. as the maximum. So for instance, someone who is exposed to a known case should stay in isolation for 14 days after they've been exposed. And the reason for that is if you become ill, we don't want you out in public while you're ill and contagious. And if 14 days has passed after your exposure, your risk of actually getting ill is extremely low. This is a virus we know pretty solidly now is droplet spread. It's spread like the flu virus is spread. We cough or sneeze the infectious particles out. They land on our environment, and then we touch those environmental surfaces, and then we touch our eyes, nose, or mouth, and we become infected.
So you can take it in through your eyes?
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually mucous membranes are what the virus attaches to and invades your body. So the inside of our eyes is a mucous membrane.
So I have to report, and I'm sure you know this because of your position, but this is causing quite a sensation through the community, and I've been hearing a lot of different attitudes about it, ranging from, well, for example, I'm a member of the Quaker meeting here, and there was going to be a memorial service for one of our members who spent his last months in Seattle, and he has many friends in Seattle. That was going to take place on Saturday. And then on Sunday is our regular meeting for worship. And both of those events have, as of about an hour ago, been postponed or canceled. So that's at one extreme of response. At the other end would be, for example, Donald Trump yesterday saying, there's no real reason that you shouldn't go to work. Most likely all that's going to happen is you're going to have a mild illness and you're going to be better. I wonder if you could comment on those two extremes of reaction.
I'll comment on the second one first, and that is if I were to list people from the most credible to the least credible in terms of giving health advice about COVID-19, I would put the President of the United States at the absolute bottom of that list. That is politically motivated information. And what people need is science-based information. Because if you believe in science, that's what's going to improve your chances of staying well and avoiding this infection. In terms of cancellation or postponement of events, it's complicated because it's a fast-moving picture. I could have confidently told you 2 weeks ago that there would be no need to do that kind of alteration of plans. But we know now, because of actually delayed access to testing, which again was a federal issue, that this infection has been spreading in the King County and Snohomish County area in a low-grade manner for the last 6 weeks. And that's a testament to how subtle the symptoms are. The people who have got it did not feel any different than common cold or influenza. That's the good news. The bad news is that some got very ill, and our current mortality count is 10. And it's just going, the more tests they do, the more it'll go up. Fundamentally, we don't know how widespread this is in the King County area, given its nature that it can have cases that have very few symptoms. So we can't really tell with the accuracy that we would like to who's been exposed. We're not recommending, as of today, that people cancel get-togethers or meetings. But it's not unreasonable to think that if people are coming from a area where transmission is occurring, and right now sort of the epicenters are the Kirkland area of King County and to a lesser extent Snohomish County, erring on the side of caution in this kind of situation for a non-critical meeting that can be done at another time is not unreasonable. What we can say as this progresses, and we really believe it will, we believe this will spread all over the state because we can slow it down, but we can't absolutely contain it. As that happens, there'll be more and more of a rationale to do what King County is doing, which are what are called community mitigation measures, where you start canceling certain events and you do a whole range of things that result in what's known as social distancing. You help people do the things they would normally do, only further apart. Because we know with droplet spread infections like COVID-19, you have to be pretty close to someone to catch it. You have to, literally, we're saying 6 feet. In reality, the danger zone is even less than that. The World Health Organization says 1 meter, which is around 3 feet. And what goes on in that danger zone is someone who has it and coughs out, if you breathe that in before those droplets have a chance to hit the ground, then that's a high-risk exposure. You are very likely to get that infection. So we do things to try to prevent or mitigate that. We have people who have active infections wear masks, and that traps the droplets. We'd like them to be minimizing their movement around the community, but you know, most people, the vast majority of people with coughs and colds have influenza or one of the many common cold viruses.
We had a scare earlier this week, right? I mean, there was a press release that came out from Chimicum Schools about a couple of kids who thought they might have been exposed, and those kids are quarantined.
We certainly discourage those kind of press releases on the part of the school, because they're not based on good information. And sometimes they run the risk of violating privacy and confidentiality rights, because you know, we will be doing testing of people who have been exposed to known cases. And those are medical tests that are every bit as confidential as if you go to a clinic and get a pap test or...
I don't think the students were named in the press release.
Yeah.
But
Well, but even we have to be very cautious in a rural area, because even saying X number of students left school, people actually know who those students are. They know who's not there that day. So we've in effect identified them, and so we're both very...
It seems like a really delicate balance. I mean, like, just suppose these two kids actually had a real exposure, then it seems like it would be in the public interest for that to be known.
Right, and the way we walk this balance is that these are the decisions that we as public health experts who are trained in this, who I in particular am board certified in this field, is we balance these privacy and confidentiality and public need to know, right to know. And so when we have accurate information, we will tell people, because it's information that is important to them. If someone's exposed to this, they need to watch for the signs of the infection, and they need to do specific things if they see those signs. And so we have very specific advice for people who are exposed, but we don't want people to be speculating on exposure or stigmatizing people. You know, initially it was Asians were all the target. You know, if you were an Asian wearing a face mask or sometimes even not, You were stigmatized as having this Chinese coronavirus infection. That's starting to go away as it becomes more prevalent in the population. But we don't want to stigmatize anyone. It's just, it's inevitable with something like this that rumors will flourish. And but we don't want school officials putting out information that has not been verified with the health department.
I went and I looked up the statistics about last year's, what was characterized as a moderately severe flu. In the United States, some 35 million people got that flu. And that is despite the best efforts to do vaccination programs and so on. 500,000 or so were hospitalized with it, and 35,000 died. And those all seem like really big numbers to me. Now, of course, 35 million is a much, much bigger number than 35,000. And if you work the percentages out, it's like, you know, a fraction of a percent. So why the difference?
One in a thousand people who get influenza die of it.
Right. So, and obviously, you know, every single year, the CDC and everyone, they're out there trying to figure out what next year's flu is going to look like and come up with a vaccine that works. And in some years, we're more successful than others. But I don't recall an instance, even with SARS and MERS, you know, like other coronaviruses that came, where the world economy, like, you know, quite shut down in the way this has. So I'm just wondering whether there's a difference in approach that the Jefferson County Public Health Department is having for the coronavirus as opposed to this year's flu. And then part of the question is, what is going on with the flu this year?
Well, the flu is still going on. Fortunately, we're having a kind of a mild to moderate year, as opposed to 2 years ago when we had a really bad flu year in excess of 80,000 deaths. And typically, it runs between 20,000 and 80,000 excess deaths a year. Influenza is a killer disease, and that's why we take strenuous public health precautions and strategies to try to lower the death count. And the things we do on influenza are helping us respond to COVID-19, because we have long planned for influenza pandemics. When a new strain of influenza is introduced into the human population, everybody's susceptible to it. It occurred in 1918, in 1957, in 1968, and again in 2009. And the last one was incredibly mild, so it didn't register. But we could have a replay of the 1918 pandemic. So we have all these plans. And as it turns out, the coronavirus is very similar to influenza in some ways. It's spread the same way. It causes mild illness in some people and severe illness in others. So that gives us a starting point. You know, we're in effect using our pandemic response plans as the starting point for a customized plan to this. What's got people concerned is two main factors. Is one, we're still in the very initial stages of this, but we realize that this is highly infectious. So unlike SARS or MERS, which weren't as infectious. Anyone who gets those gets very ill, and so it's much easier to identify them. It's highly infectious, and in the initial data, we're seeing fairly high what we call case fatality rates. So the ratio of the number of people who die relative to the number of people who are infected. And we know they're not completely accurate. In fact, they're not very accurate right now because they're underestimating the number of people that are infected. But you know, this is the era where we have some very sophisticated computer modeling, and we think that the true infection fatality rate is somewhere between 0.1 and 1%. So it's at least as high as influenza. And it may be 10 or 20 times higher than influenza. And the difference, the big difference between annual seasonal influenza and a new novel coronavirus is not everyone is susceptible to influenza. People have vaccination, people have prior immunity, whereas we're all susceptible to a novel coronavirus. No, it's never existed before. No one's immune. And so when it spreads in populations, you can have very large numbers who get infected. And even though most aren't very ill, so many people are infected that the people that need to be hospitalized or the people that ultimately succumb, that can be a very large number. And the surge of medical care needed is very hard for our healthcare system to accommodate because we don't build hospitals that have twice as many beds as they need. You know, hospitals are usually full. So our highest priority is getting ready for the surge in medical care. So we've been working very closely with Jefferson Healthcare. We have the advantage that all of the medical care in Jefferson County is organized under one organization. That's a real advantage for me. And we've been taking steps to get rid of the surge. The hospital has plans to, when the need arises, to open up additional clinic space to evaluate people with respiratory illness.
But they're not buying a motel. They're not buying Manresa Castle.
No, it's existing facilities, but it's really a fortunate thing that this is available, because it means we can add on to the existing capacity and accommodate people who are getting ill. And we hope in the near future that we're going to have ready availability to and access to diagnostic tests. We don't have that now. We can only test about 80, 90 specimens a day in Washington State.
In all of Washington State. And there's no locally available tests here.
No. And this is with the state public health lab in Shoreline running virtually round-the-clock shifts and 9 runs a day. And so it takes more than just the test kits that the federal government has finally released. It takes these multi-million dollar machines that you put the test kits into to analyze them. And it's a very meticulous test. You can get it wrong if you don't do it just right. And so what people have been very busy doing this week is University of Washington has the capacity to do thousands of tests a day. They had not been able to get the FDA to permit that up until the end of last month, but now they are. So now they're standing up this high capacity testing capability that we're told they're just getting it up and running. And with each passing day, they'll be able to do more and more. So right now, it's very hard for us to get test results. I'm hoping in a week for today, it will be easier. And 2 weeks from today, we'll be able to test anyone that it makes sense to test. So, but right now we're dealing with resource limitations, and that's part of emergency preparedness.
Are there people who've been asking for tests who've been turned down?
I'm not aware of, from a patient standpoint, that people are asking for tests. From a standpoint of clinicians, of physicians asking for tests, yes, all over the state, people have wanted to do testing, and right now it's very stringent criteria. You have to be exposed to a known case, or you have to have a severe form of pneumonia and no other explanation for it, or you have to be sick and having traveled to one of these high outbreak countries. So,
I mean, the cases we've seen in Washington and in California, by and large, have been from people who had no known exposure.
Yeah, well, we know it's spreading. We don't have evidence to say that it's rapid, but it's progressive, and it's spreading. And we don't have the testing capacity to do what we would like to do, which is called surveillance testing, where we're just, randomly sampling communities and doing tests of people who have respiratory illnesses and seeing which, if any of them, are this COVID-19 virus. Because when we cannot tell who has it based on symptoms. The symptoms are exactly the same as influenza or the common cold. So we cannot differentiate it that way. We can only differentiate it based on this test result. And we're most suspicious of it in people who are unusually ill, who have these severe kinds of pneumonia that are not responsive to antibiotics, that are different than we generally see with influenza. That's a priority for testing.
Right. How shall we, as a population, avoid getting this disease in the first place? And what should we do if we think we may have gotten it?
We're putting out very detailed guidance of that. So these will be on our websites, and the long version of the answer to that question will be on our website, also on the Department of Health website. And it's really worth looking at this because it helps educate us as to the nature of this infection and how to prevent it. The short answer to it is that this will spread person to person, and the way we stop it from spreading is that the droplets that an infected person puts out during the infection, you want to avoid being exposed to those. So you want to keep your distance from people that are ill. You want to wash your hands because your hands are always being contaminated in your environment. So you want to wash your hands before, what we're saying now, before you touch your face. Specifically, it's your eyes, nose, and mouth. But if you don't touch your face, you're not touching any of those. And then also wash your hands before you eat food with your hands, because that's like touching your face. Then if you do become ill, stay home, even if you know what's causing the illness or not, because you'll spread influenza and the common cold too. Kids who are sick should stay home from school. As this moves through, we're going to be having people stay home from work and stay home from school somewhat longer than they usually do. We have been saying 24 hours after the fever is gone. We're going to be expanding that with COVID-19. It's going to be more like 72 hours. What we're trying to do as the science of this emerges, we're reacting to that science. We're learning from China that quarantine was very valuable in slowing things down. And quarantine is a term. Isolation is when people who are sick stay home. Quarantine is when people who were exposed and don't know if they're going to get sick or not stay home. So we know from the Chinese information that quarantine is valuable. So we're going to keep doing that.
On Friday, March 6th, the day after this interview with Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke was conducted, the first confirmed case of COVID-19 was registered in Jefferson County. In response to growing concerns about the COVID-19 virus, Jefferson Healthcare has launched a dedicated COVID-19 respiratory illness nurse consult line to answer specific questions regarding the virus and to address exposure concerns. That number is 360-344-3094. Callers to that number will receive a follow-up call from a nurse within 24 to 48 hours for evaluation and possible scheduling for an appointment at a dedicated COVID-19 respiratory evaluation station. That number once again is 360-344-3094. As part of the plan to halt the spread of this highly contagious virus, unnecessary visits to the Jefferson Healthcare Hospital, including the cafeteria, are strongly discouraged until further notice. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and repeats the following Saturday at noon. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.